This is Law and Disorder.
Today we bring you a Law and Disorder exclusive. Hear the real motives behind the Bloomberg administration's refusal to grant a political protest permit during the 2004 Republican National Convention.
Wondered why you couldn't protest at the Great Lawn in Central Park during the Republican convention? Well, now there's emails that show you why. They didn't want you there politically.
A first-of-its-kind legal battle. Two humanitarian aid activists are facing 15 years in prison and $500,000 in fines for assisting three people in dire need of emergency medical attention.
Giving people food and water, taking them to a hospital in the Arizona desert, is now a crime.
We'll also talk with attorney Flint Taylor, who will update listeners on the Chicago torture case.
It's getting worse and worse for public officials in Chicago. Now it looks like Mayor Daley may have been implicated in the torture of people in the 80s, or at least covering it up.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Newly released internal documents reveal that city officials, including New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, actively participated in a prearranged plan 2 years ago to deny large political protests on the Great Lawn in Central Park. In one such email, the Parks Department wrote, quote, "It's very important that we do not permit any big or political events between August 23rd and September 6, 2004. It's really important for us to keep track of any large events, over 1,000 people, and any rallies or events that seem sensitive or political in nature." Joining us today is Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, one of the attorneys who filed a lawsuit challenging New York City's protest permitting scheme. Mara is also with the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Committee. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Mara.
Thank you.
Can you begin by giving us a nutshell summary of why the Central Park lawsuit was brought 2 years ago?
The lawsuit was originally brought in the summer of 2004 when the city of New York was working to bar protesters from assembling and mass assembling in Central Park, in the Great Lawn of Central Park. And there were a number of groups who were seeking a protest in the Great Lawn of Central Park during the Republican National Convention. It became very clear that the city was barring and denying permits on unconstitutional grounds. And we went into court on behalf of the National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition, who had intended to hold a civil rights and anti-war rally on August 28th to seek an injunction in the court to allow them to go forward with that rally.
Now, when you say that they were making decisions based on unconstitutional grounds, can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, in the period leading up to the RNC, the city was denying permits, giving constantly shifting rationale for why people who want to express a political point of view could not assemble in the Great Lawn of Central Park. And in Manhattan, as everyone knows, if you want to come together in mass assembly for a rally, there really is no other location other than Central Park, and particularly the Great Lawn, where you can do that. I mean, it's one thing to be segmented out on city streets and sort of funneled and splintered, but if you want to see each other and hear each other and have a political rally, there is no other primary assembly place where you can be like Central Park. And they were trying to push everyone to the outer boroughs because it was really clear they didn't want to have this huge show of rallying opposition while Bush was in town and during the RNC.
With all the delegates here.
That's right. And they were telling us, they would tell us First, they would give us no reason why we couldn't have the space. And then they would give us, like, a new reason. And they were giving us reasons only in their opposition motions to our motion for an emergency preliminary injunction, which, if they had a legitimate basis for denying access to the lawn, you think that they could have come up with it at some point leading up to a court hearing. But as we proceeded and brought this litigation, even in the court hearing, the rationales they were presenting, each one was being defeated, even in that very hearing.
Was the city allowing any kinds of gatherings? Weren't there some entertainment, corporate-sponsored events that were being allowed on the Great Lawn?
Well, that's right. The main thing, and everyone probably remembers this, is they kept saying it would hurt the grass, that the grass was so delicate because of the renovation of the Great Lawn, and if you had all these people coming in for an anti-war protest, it was going to permanently damage the grass, and they kept saying it would turn Central Park back into a dust bowl. Now, just within the year prior, just in September of the year before, they had allowed the Dave Matthews Band to have a massive concert with multiple tractor trailers set up on a huge, huge stage and tens of thousands of people, 85,000 by their own count, which exceeds what they said the capacity was. And this was sponsored by AOL Time Warner. So obviously, if you were a corporate-sponsored and politically approved event, you could have the Great Lawn. If you wanted to come and express opposition to the war, you couldn't use it.
Tell us about the documents that you have uncovered during the discovery process of your litigation. Are they emails?
What we've obtained, because after the initial preliminary injunction phase, which we did not win, the judge would not order the city to allow our plaintiffs access to the Great Lawn. We went forward with the litigation. We went forward to demand change to the illegal permitting system in New York, as well as to explore the basis for these original denials. So we've been litigating since 2004, ongoing litigation against the City of New York, against Bloomberg, on behalf of National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition, to strike down the illegal permitting system, as well as challenging the new regs that people may have seen that they promulgated over the past year, which actually are a direct response to our litigation. They began thinking they need to come up with regs and hoping those would pass muster, and we believe they do not either. We believe that they are equally inadequate and constitutionally violative.
So, and that they still allow discretion.
Yes, I mean, they've done nothing and they're showing nothing that would indicate there's a change in the way that they will handle permitting processes. I mean, it should be really a completely neutral self-executing system. You should apply, you should be, you know, a first-in-time situation, you get it or you don't get it. But they're putting very particular restrictions on the size of assembly that is not supported by even their own expert who we've deposed. They're putting restrictions on in terms of how many a year, which again is not how many assemblies will be allowed a year. And of course, you know, every summer they allow the opera to come twice and the Philharmonic to come twice. And that's never been a problem for them. Again, these are also corporate-sponsored events. And it's not people holding political opposition points of view to the U.S. government.
All right, let's get back to the demonstration, because all of us here wanted to go on it. We all remember it very well when the Republicans were in town. And we all suspected that newly minted Republican Mayor Mike and Bush and his people were in collusion to not allow us to demonstrate. And now all this stuff is coming out, right? What have you been finding out?
It's not shocking, right, I guess, to any of us that were paying attention at the time, but yet the internal documents that we've obtained, some of which they tried to withhold but we fought for, include emails, internal memoranda, as well as the depositions we took. We've deposed multiple city officials, Parks Department officials, and mayor's office officials. One email, for example, reads, "It is very important that we do not permit any big or political events for the period between August 23rd and September 6, 2004. That's the period of the RNC. It goes on to say, it's really important for us to keep track of any large events over 1,000 people and any rallies or events that seem sensitive or political in nature." That's an email from the Parks Department.
Now, was the mayor privy to any of these emails?
Yes, he was.
Because wasn't there a denial that Mayor Bloomberg knew anything about this?
Mayor Bloomberg submitted a sworn affidavit in this litigation in order to avoid being deposed, in which he said he had no knowledge of these discussions, of these meetings, other than just a general issue that there was things about permits going on. But in fact, we obtained memoranda and emails that show that Mayor Bloomberg was having meetings with the Parks Commissioner, Adrian Benepe, specifically about the denial of the permit to the National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition, that there were meetings taking place where they were talking about that their official position that there would be a ban on rallies in Central Park overall in advance of the RNC, that they were trying to get him in agreement with that position, notably because the police department didn't share that position. The police department didn't have a problem with a rally in the Great Lawn of Central Park.
So the mayor and his administration essentially misled the press, misled the public, and misled the courts.
They did. I mean, that's what it appears to us very clearly from the documents, from what they had said repeatedly during those months. They were at great pains to constantly put out public statements, to have rationales, to explain why somehow anti-war protesters couldn't access the Great Lawn. These documents make it clear that that was completely fraudulent.
Wasn't it all about the grass? Isn't that what they said?
Yeah, that's what they said.
The depositions that we took, including their official expert on grass.
They've got an expert on grass?
Yeah, they have an expert on grass. And their own expert can't even support the position, try as he might.
Michael Smith, we were recording that day, and Michael Smith came into the studio with the paper in his hand, furious. And he was the first person to say, hey, they had those corporate events. Dave Matthews was on the lawn last year or whatever, and they have this and they have that. It's good to see the truth finally coming out.
Now, Mara, you've released these documents. Where can our listeners read them?
You can see the documents on our website, which is www.justiceonline.org. That's all one word.
Justiceonline.org.
And we've put out a substantial number of the documents from the litigation.
Have you had any response from officials, city officials?
Well, we're still in litigation with them, so we're going back into court actually at the end of this week again on the same issue.
Now, Mara, hasn't the partnership had previous success in litigating to end discretionary permitting schemes in other cities, Philadelphia?
We have. We succeeded in striking down the city of Philadelphia's discretionary legal permitting system a few years ago, and we litigate a lot of these cases as well in Washington, D.C. It's just remarkable that New York City maintains this kind of completely illegal system. I mean, it really looks sort of like a Jim Crow-era sheriff's office permitting system, the way that they're operating, and this is in New York City.
Mara, what do you think the chances are for success in this?
Well, we believe that the case is very strong, and we believe that both what they did at the time and what they're continuing to do is flatly unconstitutional and is demonstrably unconstitutional. And so, of course, we are always hopeful that we will be able to get justice in the court system and bring an end to these practices.
If listeners want to read the actual complaint in the case, is that also on your website?
I believe it is. I believe it's up on the Justice Online website, and the documents as well are also up there.
All right, we'll put a link to that on lawanddisorder.org. That's our website. Mara, thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder. We look forward to following the outcome of this important case.
We want to interview you again when we win this case.
That's right.
Good work.
I would be happy to come back, and thanks so much for having me today.
Okay.
Thanks, Mara.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
This is juicy stuff. We all knew it at the time, but now getting these documents
that
they were conspiring and lying.
The emails.
Yeah.
Get the mayor caught in a lie.
It's amazing. In an era of FOIAs, they must really have had a lot of faith in their ability to keep all this private. Did they think that we wouldn't dig and find this out?
A lot of this stuff we're not finding out, but
this
is one of the first scandals to come along. The guys are not only liars, they're talking about democracy, and here they won't let people gather.
Was the Lennon concert mentioned? The attempt to get the park for the demonstrations, somebody for some group that was involved with John Lennon tried to get it for a big memorial concert or something for Lennon. And they had to basically write back, well, we can't give it to you because we just turned down the RNC, and how's it going to look if we give it to you now after we just turned them down, essentially, because we don't have any excuse.
That was mentioned in some of the documents.
Right.
It was.
Yeah. It was mentioned. That's the point. Yeah. They actually found that document where they sort of say, well, we're in a pickle now because we can't give it to you because we just turned down these political protests.
Yeah, exactly. So first they kill democracy, and then they kill culture. And the last thing they leave us with is the Dave Matthews Band.
That was Mara Verheiden Hilliard, one of the attorneys litigating the Great Lawn protest permit case, dating back to the 2004 Republican National Convention. Mara is also a national co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild's Mass Defense Committee. previous shows, we've interviewed attorneys Flint Taylor and Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office about a landmark domestic torture case in Chicago. It's a case rarely reported on outside the Chicago media. We promise to keep you up to date on emerging developments, and recently caught up with Flint Taylor in the middle of his court appearances. As you may recall, high-level police and other officials in that city have been covering up a series of gross abuses of authority, including torture.
Flint Taylor is one of the leaders of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Law firm started out 30 years ago representing the family of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark when they were assassinated by the Chicago police, two leaders of the Black Panther Party. They've since become famous in Chicago for the defense of black people against the police for police abuse. Flint pioneered, starting 20 years ago, the cases that are now coming to light where he has shown that some 200 people, all black, were tortured by the Chicago police, false confessions. Big cover-up by the establishment in Chicago. The cover-up is unwinding. Flint has just named Mayor Daley as a defendant in a lawsuit. There's a big storm in Chicago. Tell our listeners out there why the Chicago powers that be are calling you and your law firm legal hucksters.
Well, we're really hitting a nerve here, and the fact is that we have a scandal that just is getting rolling downhill, both in terms of the involvement of the mayor when he was state's attorney of Cook County, the involvement of the Cook County state's attorney when he was first assistant state's attorney, the involvement of former mayors and police superintendents, and even though this special prosecutor's report did its level best to try to cover over all of this, the fact of the matter is, in between the lines, there is a tremendous amount of evidence that shows not only a pattern and practice of torture, but the fact is that the chief state's attorney at the time, Richard Daley, did nothing to prosecute when it was presented to him that there was evidence of torture.
And he's now your mayor, of course.
He's been the mayor for some time, and of course he comes from a proud family of tyrants, starting with Richard Sr., who was the mayor here for 30 years.
Well, we remember him well.
Of course.
What's happening with Jesse Jackson Jr.? I understand he wants to run for mayor. He's making some hay out of this scandal.
There are several people who have stepped forward talking about it very strongly, and Jesse Jackson Jr. is one. Another is a longtime progressive Puerto Rican U.S. congressman by the name of Luis Gutierrez. He spoke out against Daley. I think it's empowering people and emboldening people who have felt that this was a one-party, one-horse town to actually think that they could challenge the mayor in a way that's not reminiscent of Harold Washington 23 years ago.
Very exciting.
Flint, we've been following your case pretty closely on Law and Disorder, so our regular listeners are aware of what this is all about. But for those who have just joined us, can you explain what this is?
What this is and what the recent report is, I think.
Okay, well, starting in 1972 and going all the way into the 90s, there was a commander at an area station here, a detective area, who was regularly with his men torturing suspects into giving false confessions, sending them to death row, sending them to life in prison, using techniques such as putting bags over people's heads, electric shocking them, doing mock executions, beating them with rubber truncheons, all kinds of things you would expect to be happening in other areas of the world where torture reigns. But it was happening here in Chicago. Nothing was really done about it other than community outrage and some litigation actually got this guy, his name was Burge, fired back in the 90s. However, nothing more was really done until the governor pardoned several people on the basis of the fact that their confessions were tortured from them. Then a special prosecutor was appointed 20 years later because the prosecutor, Richard Devine, was the same Richard Devine who represented Burge when he was in private practice. So he obviously was doing nothing to investigate the developing evidence of torture. So they appointed a special prosecutor. Unfortunately, they appointed one that was connected to Richard Daley, the mayor, connected to the city of Chicago. And after 4.5 years and $7 million, they issued a report that was basically a whitewash. And not only was it a whitewash in that it underplayed the systemic nature of the torture, although they grudgingly admitted at a press conference after they released their report that at least 70 70 of the 140 people that they had looked into were tortured. But they did make some findings that in specific cases there was criminal conduct by Burge and his men. But they said, we're sorry, but the statute of limitations has run. Well, statute of limitations had not run on things like perjury, obstruction of justice, continuing RICO conspiracy, that kind of thing. So it raised an outrage when this report was released a month or two ago. What also has raised a major outrage by the special prosecutor's report is that they waited until after they'd already said they were going to file it, until after the press started to ask probing questions about the role of the mayor, who was the state's attorney, Richard Daley, and the role of the Cook County state's attorney, who was the first assistant under Daley, when the original allegations arose and when the evidence of torture was presented directly to them. So now there's a tremendous whirlwind of publicity and charges, and that the special prosecutor was completely connected, which is being shown to be true, and that this report was nothing but a whitewash that came straight from City Hall. I had a press conference because I subpoenaed all the testimony of all these officials like Daley and Brzezek, the superintendent at the time. And
the testimony they made before this special commission, right?
Yes, which they made only last month after 4.5 years and after they'd already decided what they were going to do. You know, it was a love fest. And any time that a serious question was proposed, their lawyer would hop in. Say, you don't recall that, do you? And of course they wouldn't.
Yeah, I read your piece about Daley and how he was almost answered that he remembered a particular letter about torture, and the lawyer jumps in and says, don't forget, if you don't remember,
you're not supposed to do that in a deposition.
Well, but in all of these statements, even though they actually didn't ask the right follow-up questions and didn't interrogate them properly, we still have the outlines of an amazing conspiracy to obstruct justice back in the early 80s, when it was brought to the attention of Daley and Devine as prosecutors that there was criminal conduct on the part of Burge in this celebrated Andrew Wilson case, that they chose, rather than to look into it, to investigate or to prosecute Burge at that time, they chose to defend all of that action. So the question becomes why there wasn't an investigation of these high public officials, and I guess the answer is because they run the city. And we're now looking to the feds and to Patrick Fitzgerald, and I do it with a certain amount of skepticism and cynicism, but nonetheless, he's taken on Daley in the past, he's taken on Bush's people in the past, so it's time for him to take on Daley in the torture case.
That would be great.
We're squarely presenting that to him, and so is the public, and the statute of limitations defense, in the sense that we can't prosecute now, is a sham, and it's been shown in several columns in the newspapers by the law professors and others that it is a sham, and that there is a continuing obstruction of justice, and there's a continuing RICO conspiracy under the Racketeering Influences Act.
Now, how many years have you been at this, Flint, getting at this story?
I started representing Andrew Wilson, one of the victims, in 1986, so I've been at this investigation and litigation for 20 years.
Now, Andrew Wilson was on death row at some point?
Well, he was, and he's the man who was tortured so obviously. He was burned on a radiator, he was electric shocked, he was bagged with a plastic bag, he was kicked. They were so unthinking in terms of the sophistication of how they treated him, because he was charged with killing two white cops, that they left all the evidence on his body. So that's the one that really, really put it squarely in the lap of the now mayor and the now state's attorney, because there was no way they could deny that he'd been tortured. But of course they did, and of course they didn't investigate Burge, because if they did investigate Burge, they would have blown up their own prosecution of their cop killer defendant. So they had a huge conflict of interest, and so they obstructed justice and chose not to proceed. Now, I think that people in the press are starting to understand that. And as we gave them all the testimony today that shows that the police superintendent had informed them specifically of the evidence of torture, that a doctor that headed up the prison where Wilson was brought found evidence of torture on his body, and that was given to Richard Daley by the police superintendent. So it's not like they have deniability like they have in most cases. There's documentary evidence that they were informed and that they continued to be informed, and now the testimony shows they made a conscious decision not to prosecute.
Now, is this coming out as part of a civil case that you have, Flint?
Yeah, it is. It's coming, as I said, because we have a civil case, we're able to subpoena
right.
his testimony, because at this point, Devine is as a defendant. We have a claim of a pattern and practice of city police torture, and we're preparing an amendment to join the mayor as
That's
a defendant.
Great. I'd love to see that complaint. We should put it up on our website.
Yeah, you get it. You can have it. Hopefully it'll make a political as well as legal statement.
You send it to me, and I'll get it up on our website.
You got it.
I just have one observation and ask your comment on it. I remember I was born in Chicago, and I grew up in the area, and I remember when Lenny Bruce came entertained one time in the early 60s, and he had a whole thing about Chicago, and he said, Chicago is so corrupt, it's thrilling. And I think you're proving Lenny Bruce right.
Again and again and again. You know, we had a breath of fresh air for a while when Harold Washington was elected. And, you know, he was elected primarily on the issue of police brutality. So it could be a deja vu. The mayor has already been weakened by the fact that he's caught in the middle of a scandal called the hiring truck scandal. And some of his people just went down in a big RICO conviction. So he's vulnerable more than he has been in the 15 years he's been mayor, and people are starting to seize on it. And I think particular outrage in the black community is bubbling up over this report and over the fact that $7 million was paid to come up with this whitewash. $10 million has been paid by the city to defend Burge in all of these torture cases. And the mayor's fingerprints are on all of it.
How many of the people that were tortured were black?
All of them.
All of them?
All of them were black. Almost all of the torturers were white. There was a lot of racial components to the torture, you know, the kinds of racial epithets being used. Obviously, the kind of torture harkens back to slavery and all of that. And as well, we've been able to get, surprisingly or not, this shows how arrogant they are, many of these guys to admit that they use the term again and again in the station house in their general conversation. So it's clearly a racially motivated torture, and makes it even more outrageous.
This is an amazing report, and we're really, I can't tell you how it pleases me that you've stuck with this and done this kind of work, which, of course, is the PLO, and you have done this People's Law Office for a very, very long time. But it's an amazing report and a sad one. Let me ask you just one last thing. Was anybody actually executed as a result of these confessions?
No. There was one man who was on death row and was rescued 48 hours before he was executed.
Wow.
Preliminarily on an issue of IQ, but later on he was exonerated. But the men that were on death row were there for between 13 and 17 years, but Governor Ryan pardoned, you know, he granted clemency for all on death row, but he granted pardons on the basis of innocence for four men. And those are the ones who are, I guess, the fortunate isn't the right word, but in a sense, they were fortunate not only to be pardoned and let out, but they now, because they did now have lawsuits. The others who haven't been pardoned don't have lawsuits because the statute is not under Supreme Court law. They can't bring a case until they've been exonerated.
Well, again, thank you very much, Flint. Really important. And we'll keep our listeners up to date periodically.
Please,
good luck.
So.
We're really happy you're going after Mr. Daley.
Yeah,
I hope that's what we can call him in a few weeks instead of mayor. Good
well,
luck, Flint Taylor.
Thanks, Flint. That was Flint Taylor with the People's Law Office in Chicago.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Ashanti Sells and Daniel Strauss are two border activists who were arrested and are facing felony charges for providing humanitarian aid to three migrants. They face $500,000 fines and prison terms of up to 15 years. Daniel Strauss and Ashanti Sells were volunteers with the Arizona group No More Deaths, a network set up primarily to prevent deaths of migrants who were crossing the Sonoma Desert. Daniel and Ashanti were driving three men to get treatment for extreme hunger and thirst by volunteer medical professionals in Tucson when they were stopped by U.S. Border Patrol and arrested. The two activists say they will defend their actions in trial and take on the United States. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good to be on the show.
Ashanti, what are you being charged with?
Right now, Daniel and I are facing two felony charges. One charge of aiding and abetting in furtherance of illegal presence in the United States, which is basically a human smuggling charge. And a second charge of conspiracy.
What happened leading up to these charges?
Daniel and I work with an organization, No More Deaths, which is a coalition of human rights organizations and border action groups down in southern Arizona along the border that have come together in response to the thousands of deaths that have happened along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Especially during the summer months when temperatures get into the hundreds on a daily basis and thousands of migrants have died in the last 10 or so years. What we do is we go out into the desert and go on patrols and look for people who are in distress and give food, water, and medical assistance.
Previous part of our protocol, which we had developed with the U.S. government, was to evacuate very sick people to hospitals and clinics so they could receive the care they needed. A lot of people need to be put on IVs. They need numerous medical attention that you can't give them in the field. And part of our protocol was to evacuate people to hospitals and clinics as a life-saving measure. And on the day of Daniel and my arrest, we were evacuating three men who had been found in the desert. They had been lost for 4 days. They had had nothing to eat for those 4 days, and the only water they'd had to drink was from cattle tanks that are throughout the desert. That's extremely filthy, bacteria-laden water. And they were suffering bacterial infections that were causing them to vomit and have diarrhea, which will rapidly causing dehydration in somebody who's already dehydrated. And they all had blisters on their feet so bad they couldn't even walk. And this is a clear case that they were in need of evacuation.
Give us a sense of what it's like for someone crossing the border. What do they face? How long are they walking? What kind of terrain? How hot is it?
The trip through the Arizona desert is seriously miserable, especially during the summer. Migrants are usually traveling in groups between 30 and 100 people, all traveling with a single guide or coyote, and they're paying $2,000 per person to make this trip. So these coyotes really don't think very much about the life of a single person who becomes ill, who falls behind. They really are concerned about getting the whole group across and receive all this money on the other end. So we see a lot of people who have fallen, people who are old or are sick before they started, who just can't make it and they get left behind in the desert. They have no idea how far it is to help, whether they can get help if they do reach a town. They get heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and it's a really miserable, terrible way to die.
So the people that these are the people who fall behind. Those are the people that you're assisting.
For the most part, we do encounter large groups of people as well, and then we give everyone we find food and water.
We do intentional patrols. We have a 24-hour camp that we set up in one of the more highly trafficked areas of the border, where we run patrols out of that area in search of people in distress. And we do driving patrols, and we also do walking patrols on the footpaths that people take when they cross the border. And in this instance, there were nine men found on one of these footpaths about 10 miles north of the border, sitting in an arroyo, which is a dry wash. And of those nine men, these three who Daniel and I evacuated were the ones who were in dire need of medical assistance.
And how far were you driving them to get medical assistance?
The closest place where there is an operating hospital is Tucson, which is about 50 miles from the location we found them.
And Ashanti, so you had done this before, but this time they changed the rules on you and arrested you? Is that what happened?
Yes, I've been involved in this coalition, this organization, for 2 years. I participated in evacuations, and we have a very strict protocol that we follow that, like I said, was set up with the Border Patrol. We had numerous meetings with the Border Patrol. We presented our protocol and said, this is what we're doing. These are the actions we take. And in dire circumstances, we evacuate people from the desert. And whenever we do evacuation, it's always under guidance of medical professionals, and it's always under guidance of lawyers who are part of our protocol and make sure that we're acting within the law. And
Shanti, what is the protocol?
The protocol is, it's basically how we, you know, when we find people in the field in need of attention, we always give food and water. Everyone we know, everyone we find is in need of food and water. And there is, the protocol is more specific along the lines of evacuating. So if you find someone and their symptoms show that you can't just give them food and water and know they're going to be okay, you assess their condition, you ask questions, ask about their journey, ask about previous health conditions they may have, diabetes, heart conditions, and then you call a medical professional. If there isn't a medical professional with you, we try to staff all of our patrols with medical professionals, but due to lack of volunteers, sometimes we don't have that on every patrol.
The journey from where they start in Mexico to where they often get picked up in the United States could be up to 4 days of walking in these intense heat, and no one is prepared for that journey. They're carrying maybe a gallon of water, and you need that amount of water in just about half a day in order to stay hydrated in those kind of temperatures. They don't have proper food. They don't have proper footwear. The guides lie to them. They tell them it's only an hour walk or only, you know, a few-hour walk till we get to the point where we get picked up, and they wind up being out in the desert for days on end, especially if they become lost.
Daniel, how many years are you facing on these two charges?
The maximum penalty is 15 years in prison. They're very, very serious charges, and also a fine of $500,000.
And have you been getting much support from people out there that hear about it?
Yeah, we've gotten huge amounts of support from church groups, labor organizations. The Amnesty International has supported us. The ACLU has supported us.
Good.
Daniel, can we go back to the scene of the arrest? What happened when you were arrested?
Well, first off, the week of our arrest was one of the hottest weeks on record in Arizona. It was during a 45-day heat spell where temperatures over 100 degrees every day. And the week of our arrest also set a record for the number of migrants who died. 78 migrants died just in the Arizona area of the desert that week.
Wow. I've been down there then, and it's so hot that planes can't take off because the air is too thin to support an airplane.
Within the law to save lives in the desert, and it was decided that, you know, if someone is determined to be extremely ill, what we have to do is we have to call a doctor or a nurse in Tucson or someone who's with us at the moment and get their medical approval for this evacuation. So we called on this day, we called a nurse and we called a doctor and we spoke with them and we described the symptoms that the migrants were throwing up, that they had a bloody stool, that they had blisters that covered their feet and couldn't hardly walk. And the doctor and the nurse made the professional medical decision that these people needed to be brought to medical attention right away or else they could potentially die out there. So we had the three migrants in Shanti's vehicle. Every vehicle that's used for patrols for No More Deaths organization has large signs on the side that say Samaritan Patrols so that the Border Patrol and the community know who we are and what we're doing. And up until that day, it had never been a problem. We had a pretty good relationship with the Border Patrol. They would, they would wave to us as we drove by, and we'd wave back. But this day, for some reason, Border Patrol agent turned on his lights and pulled us over after following us for about 13 miles. And
when did you get arrested, actually? What was the process by which you got arrested?
Well, we were driving the three men towards Tucson, and whenever we're operating and doing patrols, we have large placards, large signs that we put on the sides of our vehicles that say Samaritans. Very, very obvious, very very open. And so we were driving towards Tucson, and the Border Patrol agent got behind us and pulled us over. And he approached the vehicle and asked Daniel and I if the men in our vehicle were illegal. And Daniel, who was driving's response was, "I don't know. We found these men in the desert. They're sick. We don't check papers. We didn't ask them their legal status before we helped them." And the agent asked the men in English, "Do you speak English?" And they didn't respond. And he declared them illegal and put us under arrest.
But who
took the men out of our care?
Who ultimately made the decision to prosecute you? That decision must have been made pretty far up the line, wouldn't you think?
From the From my understanding, it was the assistant U.S. attorney who was on call that weekend that we were arrested who made the decision to press charges.
Yeah, but doesn't that go, particularly in a case so dramatic as this, my idea, that would go even further up the line.
Shanti, was anyone else arrested from No More Deaths?
There has never been an arrest before Daniel and I, and there has not been one since. And there have been a couple cases where volunteers have been pulled over with migrants in their car. One instance, they were driving a man south. He wanted to return back to Mexico. They were taking him back. And both those two instances and both those times, the people were taken from the care of the volunteers, but no arrests were made.
Was the Border Patrol agent who pulled you over, was this a new Border Patrol agent or someone you had worked with before?
I didn't recognize the agent at all. I don't know how long he'd been on the job.
And what happened when the agent pulled you over?
He looked at the three men in the back of the car, and he asked us if they were illegal, and we said that we didn't know because we didn't check their documents, but we did know that they were sick and that they needed to go to a hospital, and that's where we were taking them. And he asked them in English, he said, "Do you guys speak English?" And they didn't respond, and he turned to us and said, "Yep, they're illegal, and you guys are under arrest." He took us right there.
Did you identify yourself as being a member of an organization that tries to help people in desperate circumstances?
Oh, for sure. You know, well, we have, first off, the signs on the side of our car, and we said, you know, we work for No More Deaths, and we're bringing these people to medical attention.
What's your understanding of what the law, what was your understanding then and now, and it may not have changed, about what the law says about what you were doing?
We are being prosecuted under the law that it is illegal to transport someone in furtherance of their illegal presence in the country. You know, our interpretation of that law that we were following was that if we brought someone to a bus station, that would be against the law because we would be furthering their presence in the United States. But bringing someone for a solely medical reason wasn't in furthering their presence in the United States. It was just saving their life. You know, that wasn't illegal under that clause.
Daniel, for the period of time that you've been making these trips, how many hospital runs would you say you've done?
Probably 8 or 9.
It's not very many.
I mean, last summer, for example, No More Deaths volunteers came across 3,000 migrants during the 3 months of operation, and 68 of those were brought to medical facilities.
Have you ever been stopped by the police and then let go?
I was pulled over one time. I didn't have anyone in the car. They were just, I don't know why they pulled me over, just to do some routine check.
Tell us a little bit about what the impact of your arrest has been on others at No More Deaths and organizations that provide humanitarian aid.
Sure. First off, it's pretty clear from looking at the facts that the government is not doing enough to stop people from dying out there on the border. Every year since policies of border militarization have put into effect, which has been starting in the early 1990s, every year has been a record number of deaths. Every year it gets worse. The more Border Patrol agents they add, the more money they spend, the more people die. So it's very clear that humanitarian assistance is greatly needed in that region. And these arrests have really put fear into people who otherwise might help someone. They might stop and give food or water, or even take someone to a hospital who really needed it. They might not do that now, and those people out there might not make it. I think it's really necessary for the government to port all humanitarian assistance on the border, whether the person's documented or not.
Yeah, I think that's
because
right.
Everyone should support human life.
Humanitarian aid, your slogan, humanitarian aid is never a crime, that we're seeing on the No More Deaths website, it's based in a very strong foundation of international law that says you never criminalize aid that saves and assists life.
How long ago did these arrests happen?
July of last year, July 2005.
And tell us a little bit about going forward now. You're going to trial when?
We are expecting to go to trial on October 3rd. This is our fourth trial date that we've been given. So, you know, I'm expecting to go, but realize that it could be postponed again. But we are preparing to go to trial on October 3rd.
Shanti, to take a step back, after you were arrested, No More Deaths continued to do the same type of work.
Yes.
So people were continuing to be assisted and picked up in the desert who were in dire need of humanitarian assistance, and yet no more arrests were made.
Yes, but I'd like to point out that even though part of our protocol is evacuation of very sick people, that just as an example, last year, due to our No More Deaths, encountered over 3,000 people in the field. And of those 3,000, 68 of those people were evacuated. And so most of what we do is hand out food and water. We see a lot of people who are already in custody with Border Patrol, and we stop and give food and water to those people because a lot of times there isn't that supply for them when they're being processed through Border Patrol. And so evacuation is one very small part of the work we do.
Seems to me, by choosing to prosecute you and not reversing that decision and now taking you to trial, they're doing to you what, say, they did to our friend here in New York, Lynn Stewart. They're making an example out of you.
Yeah, it's a test case.
Yes, I believe that too, especially in light of the proposed legislation that we're seeing, where they're looking to criminalize not only migrants themselves, but any person who assists an undocumented person anywhere in the country, whether it's a social worker, a teacher. And I do believe that this is a test case to see what will stand and what will be able to.
Assisting would even include humanitarian help, as you're given. I mean, according to the statute, I gather. I mean, that's what they'll try and say.
Contrast what they're doing to you to, say, the stance they take towards the Minutemen, who are doing the opposite to these people who are coming across looking for jobs.
Do you have any relationship to the Minutemen? I mean, do you see them in the field? I mean, what, you ever hear about them? Do they harass you guys?
I personally haven't had a lot of interactions with them in the field. I've interacted with them at some, in-town protests, that sort of thing. There are other groups that work more closely. There's a group in southern Arizona called the Legal Observers, which watch the Minutemen to make sure that they aren't committing any abuses. But I personally haven't had a lot of interaction with the Minutemen.
Can you just explain what the Minutemen are, who they are?
The Minutemen, to my understanding, are a volunteer group of civilians who believe that the border is not being enforced well enough and that it's their duty to come to the border and help enforce it. And they do that by watching the border with weapons, with guns. And any group of migrants they may see, they call the Border Patrol or what I consider to be an extreme human rights violation, they will round those people up and hold them at gunpoint until the Border Patrol comes and gets them.
So these people are racist vigilantes that the United States government supports, and you people are just trying to prevent suffering and death are being prosecuted in a nutshell.
You know, and the government hasn't come out and said it straight out. They support the Minutemen, but the Minutemen have never had any sort of legal action taken against them for holding people at gunpoint.
Shanti, do you know if the Minutemen have ever actually fired their weapons?
Unfortunately, I don't know a lot about their actions. And again, I don't believe they're really that effective at what they do. You know, they come to the border for about a month of the year in April. They have a strong presence. And they set up camp in a certain area and declare that this 5 or 10 mile radius is going to, they're going to keep this, you know, migrant-free zone. And they may be effective in that area, but the truth is people just go around them.
If people want to give you some support for the trial, is there a website? Is there a place people can go to find out more?
Absolutely. We've been mounting a campaign for the past year called Humanitarian Aid is Never a Crime, where we have raised awareness for the work No More Deaths does and the trial that Daniel and I are facing. Our website, www.nomoredeaths.org, has all that information. We're in the midst of our summer action right now. We're running projects. We're continuing a camp in the desert. We're also doing projects in northern Mexico, meeting buses of deportees and giving them supplies they need, food and water, medical assistance, because a lot of times people are deported who are in severe medical distress and are not given the care in Border Patrol. So we're trying to give them that care on the Mexican. But we're always calling if there are people who feel they can take some time out and come down and volunteer. It's an amazing experience. I think it's very important for people in other parts of the country to really understand what's going on, to come here and work it and live it. But we're also in need of all sorts of support, financial, political, and especially as the trial gets closer in September, that we'll be picking up that effort strongly again.
You and Shanti are both 23, yes?
I'm 24.
You're 24.
At the moment, I think Shanti's still 24.
How many years have you been doing this?
2 summers so far.
2 summers, and it's a volunteer operation?
Yep.
What did you guys do this summer? Because you were arrested last summer. You're facing trial in the fall. What did you do this summer?
This summer, I'm not working directly in the border. I've been talking about border issues. I'm giving presentations around the country along with Shanti. Yeah. Shanti still lives down in Tucson and is working every day out in the desert, giving aid to people who are in need. The organization is completely volunteer and donation-based, so So we're constantly looking for support throughout the country, volunteers to go to Arizona and go out on patrols with us just to give financial support.
What's the shortest period of time a person can volunteer for and still do something meaningful?
We usually ask for volunteers to come for about a one-week period. Give them time to be trained, to get used to the environment out in the desert, and to still have a meaningful, helpful experience.
Daniel, we're going to put up your website, nomoredeaths.org, on our website, which is lawanddisorder.org. We'll try to help you in every way we can. We want to keep in touch with you and follow your trial and support you. And good luck to you.
Appreciate it.
Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
The first link on the No More Deaths website links to the USA homepage at Amnesty International, or you can go there directly to take an action to help out Daniel and Shanti. AmnestyUSA.org. Hit the USA page.
We'll follow this this trial and we'll report back to the listeners on it.
And they're looking for volunteers, so if people want to go down there and help, it sounds like they really could use it.
But we'll put up a link on our page also, lawanddisorder.org.
Fresno, California, January 28th, 1948, Associated Press.
That was Shanti Seltz and Daniel Strauss, two humanitarian aid activists who now face 15 years in prison and $500,000 in fines. Their crime? Assisting three people in dire need of emergency medical attention. We'll keep you updated on this first-of-its-kind legal case.
The Mexicans were being flown to the deportation center in El Centro for return to their country. The plane southbound from Oakland Airport appeared to explode before it plummeted to the ground.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The guard was Frank E. Chafin of Berkeley.
Goodbye to my one. Goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus y Maria.
The group also included Mexican nationals who had entered the United States illegally.
All they will call you will be deportees.
The crops are all in and the peaches are rotting. The oranges piled in their creosote dumps. You're flying on back to the Mexican border to pay all their back again. Goodbye to my one. Goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have your names when you write the big epic. All they will call you will be deportees. My father.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita, adios, mis amigos.
deport.